Welcome to Local Talk on KHYY Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Kay Patrick, one of your hosts for today, together with Ursula Rudenberg.
Thank you for listening in. A glimpse of the weather. 40% chance of rain and thunderstorms today, mainly after 2 p.m. We've had rain this morning. It's going to be a wet beginning of the week. There'll be a chance of rain continuing tonight and Tuesday, with temperatures in the mid-80s and a likelihood of showers and thunderstorms increasing on Wednesday and Wednesday night. Thursday and Friday should be sunny weather with temperatures in the low 80s, and we are probably looking at another sunny weekend.
And I want to thank you if you came to the KHYY birthday party this last Saturday. Sam Salamone was a first-rate entertainer. It was really good to have him performing on Douglas Avenue, and it was really good to share the evening with you, our listeners.
And the Chinese Children's Choir was wonderful. They were really cute.
They were really,
really
cute.
Really cute. And they sang some songs in Chinese and then sang Happy Birthday to KHYY both in Chinese and English.
And, of course, the Bollywood band was amazing.
Amazing.
Playing to a packed house. We really want to thank all of the performers for a wonderful time. We had a great group of sponsors, too, including Prince Copy Center, Inkblot Studios, Benjamin Design, Brekkies, Della Vitti Wine Bar, Photosynthesis, London Underground, The Fighting Burrito, Gina McAndrews Real Estate, Skunk River Cycles, Rhea Kynart Massage and Bodywork, Ames Digital Sounds, Littlewood Herbs and Teas, and Hy-Vee East, who provided the birthday cake with the KHYY logo. And I just wanted to thank them all one more time.
You're most likely aware about the violence that occurred in Charlottesville, Virginia, when white nationalists and neo-Nazis held a rally called Unite the Right Rally on Friday in response to a plan to remove a park statue of Robert E. Lee in Charlottesville, Virginia. Violence broke out between them and counter-protesters that had gathered that were mostly local people in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the clashes and protests continued into Saturday until finally a car, allegedly driven by 20-year-old Ohio resident James Alex Fields, drove into a crowd of counter-protesters, killing a woman and injuring many. Fields was arrested and charged Saturday night. Some white nationalists and neo-Nazis have praised Donald Trump's response to the events. While President Trump's reluctance to specifically criticize or distance himself from the right-wingers has drawn criticism from many. For example, Republican Senator Orrin Hatch said, "We should call evil by its name. My brother didn't give his life fighting Hitler for Nazi ideas to go unchallenged here at home." Rhea Kynart is an Ames resident who has come up with her own response to the events of the weekend. Welcome to Local Talk, Rhea.
Yes, good morning. Thank you.
Thank you for coming in. Describe exactly what you did over the weekend.
Well, I was watching the news on Saturday, getting madder and madder and more frustrated by the fact that all I was seeing was people posting and posting and posting on Facebook. And I'm like, we're just preaching to the choir here. We need to take to the streets. And I did not feel good about letting the weekend pass after what went on without an instant response.
A three-dimensional response.
That's right. So I actually used Facebook virally, put up a post about 10 hours before the event to meet at Banshell Park. It was called AIM Stands Together Against White Supremacy. Put up on Facebook, and it went viral, viral, viral. We got some musicians together. We got some poets together. And, yeah, we ended up with 350 people in Banshell Park, thanks to the help from the police and thanks from the help from all the community. It came together, and it was a beautiful thing.
You posted on Facebook and hit a nerve with a lot of people, and they wanted to be there, too.
That's correct. I sent it to a few groups like the Women's March and Indivisible, and they took it from there.
How did you get the help of the city police so quickly, and how did you get use of the Banshell Park and the Banshell?
I'm grateful to say that the sergeant that was on duty that day, and I know his first name is Mark. I apologize that I can't remember his last name. I went over and talked to him on Sunday. I said, "We've just gotten to 65 people on Facebookers coming," and I was sort of picturing just signs along Duff Avenue as people went by and honked, and then I realized, wait a minute, we're going to run out of space. Now what are we going to do? So I went and talked to the sergeant, and he said he would see if we could get the band shell, and And sure enough, he got back to me a couple hours later that we could use the band shell. There was no power because it was too short of a notice, so that was another challenge. But we solved that too.
So the police arranged it for you to use the band shell?
Yeah, well, they got the clearance, yes.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the operative idea at the beginning was just that you were going to be doing something on public space, which didn't require a permit, and then...
There were no permits. I just pictured myself standing along Duff with a sign because I had to do something.
And then things grew from there.
Yeah, I guess 349 plus other people felt the same way.
It sounds like you really hit a nerve putting something out there that people really wanted to do.
Yeah,
along
they came from
you.
Fort Dodge. They came from the
really?
Des Moines area. Yeah, we had people from out of town as well.
And you said about 350 people.
I had a person go around and count for me, and he said he lost count at 350.
That's pretty much what it looked like to me, too, when I was there. So let's listen to some of the sounds of the rally and some of the people that showed up at the rally.
I just wanted to be in solidarity with others who just deplored what happened yesterday. I mean, that's not who we are as a country. You know, we just can't condone what happened. I think that we can't let the white supremacists take their message, and we just have to stand up against it. You bet. We have to resist.
I'm here because I'm mostly scared about the whole situation yesterday. I mean, I've been living in anxiety, but yesterday just escalated the whole thing. I'm just afraid that it could happen here. It's all in the news. You hear about these people, but now it's real. And it could happen here, but I'm pleased to see that there are people against it.
What would your message be as an immigrant?
You know, most of us didn't have a choice to come here. We were scared for our lives. I mean, when I grew up, I never thought that I'd reach the age of 50. When I reached 50, I celebrated. And now I feel like I'm living a bonus life. But I want my kids to live a better life than I did because they are Americans.
And you're from?
I'm from South Africa. And I left 1982. And, you know, the regime in South Africa, my sister passed away. We had to run away. My husband and I were separated because of the apartheid system. He was forever jailed. So I feel like this is a land of opportunity. And we're hard workers. My son works two jobs. My daughter-in-law works two jobs. We work hard because nobody wants to be on welfare. We are grateful for this opportunity to be here. And we are taxpayers too. I was just grateful to be here, to be able to finally, at the age of 30, I was able to get a degree. I even managed to get a PhD eventually. We are all one nation under God, and we aspire for the same thing. The only thing that's different is the pigmentation.
No wall, no fear! Immigrants are welcome here! No wall, no fear! Immigrants are welcome here! No wall, no fear! Immigrants are welcome here!
I'm Joe Olson. I'm here because America does not stand for Nazis and intolerance like that. So we wanted to make a statement as a community, as a group, that we're not up for that.
What motivates you to come today?
Freedom. Wanting for people to have the vast expansion of the freedom that America promises. We can't single out groups and suppress them or hold them down in any way. We've got to have everybody contributing for society to work. Peace, love, let's all work together as Americans.
White silence is white violence!
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 My name is Brady Hubbard. I'm marching because I think that I have a ton of privilege. I hold dominance in my identities in so many areas, and I need to say something because this is not okay in the world I live in and the country I live in.
And why is it important to say this in Ames, Iowa?
Is white violence.
In Ames, Iowa, because I think people think, oh, it's not going to happen here. I think we're more apt to have it happen here than anywhere else. We have lots of people that haven't experienced other things and have
white
a lens they're looking through that doesn't want to accept
violence.
Everybody that is here and acknowledging wonderful difference. And so it's as important here as everywhere else.
Like the privilege that we have, you have to recognize it and don't be afraid of it. Acknowledge it. That's what a real man would do.
I'm
Miss Ursa. Lady Sha, the lady from the radio station. I see you. Hey, how are you?
Hey, why are you doing this?
For peace, for love, for compassion for all human beings. We all deserve to get treated right. My name is Kiara Chester. So I'm doing this for my generation, for my children, my grandchildren. This is bigger than me. This is for my the next generation to come. Everybody deserves to get treated fair. And I feel like every human being deserves to feel love and compassion at its highest degree. And that's it.
And this is in response to what happened in Charlottesville?
Yes.
What did you see in Charlottesville?
Hate. Hate, that's it. And the cure for hate is love and compassion for all. It's time that we express love and compassion for every human being that lives. In order for hate to be cured, we gotta show love and compassion.
Black lives matter! 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 Black lives matter!
My name's Rachel Beckwith. We were just at the rally because Black Lives Matter and white supremacy needs to be stopped.
Why does this matter in Ames, Iowa?
We're part of this country, and white supremacy and racism are everywhere. That attitude is pervasive, and it needs to be stopped, and white people need to stop it.
I'm Lori Allen, and I just participated in the gathering at Van Shell Park to stand up to white supremacy and white nationalism. And I participated because, well, all of my ancestors came here for the opportunities they had. And I realized we also pushed out a lot of people. We brought a lot of people who didn't want to come. I think it's time for us to be a place where people can pursue their own dreams without fear of persecution or being hurt or injured. And just, you know, not really thinking about the minor things like our skin color or our religions that separate us.
You're reacting partly to Charlottesville, right?
Absolutely reacting to Charlottesville.
And why do you think it's important to demonstrate today in Ames?
I think it's important to send a message of solidarity, that we see what's going on, we see who's doing it, and we're going to stand up and say we're not going to tolerate it.
Is that your message?
That's my message. We see what you're doing, we're going to stand up, and we're not going to tolerate what you're doing.
My name is Tim. I am here to stand up for a nation that we live in where everybody is equal and has equal rights.
Was it the riots in Charlottesville that prompted you to come today?
Yes, actually, my wife saw that people were meeting here today, and we decided to come down and show our support.
What would your message be?
We were all created in the image of God, and I think we're all equal.
Hi, I'm Megan O'Connor. I came today to resist Trump and everyone out there that's being racist and bigotry and hatred, and I want more peace and love in the earth and respect everyone here in America.
Is there something in particular that made you take the effort to come out today?
What happened in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the domestic terrorism that happened down there, and the white supremacists definitely encouraged me to come out today and resist and fight that.
And tell us what your sign says.
What would Wonder Woman do? WWWD. What would Wonder Woman do? Peace and love, and accept everyone for who they are, and no more violence.
This is Local Talk, and those were voices of some of the people who showed up at a spontaneous rally, somewhat spontaneous, a Facebook-generated rally started by Rhea Kinert, resident here in Ames. And folks came to speak out against the white nationalist and neo-Nazi demonstration that occurred in Charlottesville over the weekend. Rhea is here. She organized the rally. And Rhea, what are your thoughts when you hear all the really a lot of different types of people there?
Well, organized is a strong word.
It was definitely
a seat of the pants, and I'm thrilled how well it came off. It's exciting to hear so many people, some of whom I know and many of whom I do not, on that tape, that when something's right, when something's powerful, people all come together, and that's why it was just sort of swept along under its own power after a while.
One of the things I noticed was that there was not one single person that I asked to speak to that refused to speak. And usually in Ames, Iowa, about half the people you approach say, no, I don't have anything to say. But everybody was there yesterday, really, really had a message. So it was a very passionate group of people.
I noticed, Rio, when there was a group singing on the tape, you hadn't realized, you hadn't heard them. That was something that was a surprise to you here in the studio.
Well, it took on a life of its own in many ways.
Yeah.
If you want to go through the rundown, I can tell you.
Please do.
Well, Jen McClung sang first, and that was beautiful. And then I spoke a little bit to kind of give people orientation. And then we had a poet, a self-described Ames queer poet named Valine Sanguine, who did a very, very powerful poetry slam type poem. And then we had Jeanette Colton. She works for the Ames School District, and she's a Spanish language interpreter, and she spoke about the effect on kids and on our community at large, and said, "Ahora es el tiempo." Now is the time to change that.
The fear and the violence.
Yeah, the effect it has on our community, and mm-hmm. it's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had Lisa Lai, who is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, and she pointed out something I didn't know, which was the woman who was killed, whose name was Heather Heyer, or Heyer, H-E-Y-E-R. She was a civil rights activist with the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA. So she was the first casualty of what may turn into be a lot of those, I'm afraid to say. So that was important to know. And then we had Josh Hall, whose message was that he is not a particularly liberal guy for the most part. His father fought against the Nazis, and he made the point that it's not about red or blue or about a party or about Democrat or Republican. This is about what's right and human rights. And we needed to hear that. And then Ben Schrag made some beautiful music. He did a song that was taken from the poem on the side of the Statue of Liberty. And then I thought we were going to finish with a Jewish prayer from Javier Miranda.
I think he said Kaddish. Which is the
Jewish rite. It's a funeral rite, I think.
It's a funeral rite.
Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. But then, as we were going to break up, that's when it started taking a life of its own. Then Kiara Chester came forward and said, "I need to sing." So I said, "A cappella, right?" So she got up and just belted out a beautiful, beautiful song of hope and power. And then I was told, no, we're not done. We're going to march down the street. So even though that was a surprise to me, all right. So I grabbed the bullhorn and we marched down one side of Main Street and up the other. And
Any onlookers with responses, or was it pretty empty?
It was downtown Ames on a Sunday afternoon. So there were a few people in the bars that kind of gave us a thumbs up, but mostly we didn't obstruct any traffic because there really wasn't any. Police were very kind, even though it was a surprise to them, too. They blocked off Duff Avenue so we could march back to the park with no problem, and that was mm-hmm. a nice surprise, too. Everybody was very flexible yesterday, and that's what made it work.
So what do you make of all this? What's your message?
I guess I feel hopeful. I feel like we have a strong community, and if all the communities around the country were this strong, I think we could win against hatred, or at least hold it back. 350 people at the drop of a hat. People are ready. Let's do more.
I was curious whether other towns were having spontaneous rallies like this. And I actually didn't see any. Did you?
Oh, there were.
Oh, yeah. If you look on the Indivisible website, San Francisco, New York, and one other big city they mentioned had big rallies yesterday. And I know this evening in Des Moines there's one. I don't know the details, but you can look that up, too. I think there are a lot of places around the country. I think Indivisible.com seems to have the best list of that stuff.
In this case, it's not an organized initiative run by a particular organization. This was really Kieran Ames' spontaneous response. Very rapid.
Quick, yeah. Yeah, they response. Asked me, so what's your job title? And I said, Grandma.
So, Rhea, the last word here. Are you planning to become a demonstration organizer now? Did you enjoy doing it? Or
I enjoyed it, but I don't really do leadership. I think next time I'll let somebody else take the lead, but I'm certainly excited to see what comes next.
Uh-huh. Well, it sounds like you felt hopeful from it, which is what I heard from some of the other people saying, too, that
yes,
it was
hopeful for
a
sure.
positive experience to do this.
Well, there's a lot of pushback against all the haters all over the country. This was just one example.
Okay. Well, thank you, Rhea, for coming in to
thank you, Ursula.
Giving
thank
us
you,
the background.
Yes, thank you, Rhea. Yeah, such short notice.
And thank you for supporting KHOI, too, recently for our birthday party.
Yay, KHOI.
We've been hearing from Rhea Kynard, an Ames resident who organized a counter-rally in response to a rally called Unite the Right Rally, held by nationalists and neo-Nazis over the weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia. And numerous people at that rally in Ames were calling for peace, which makes this next interview especially germane and relevant. In it, I speak with retired attorney Fred Van Loo of Van Loo Mediation and Consulting. Since he retired from being an attorney, Fred has been working on conflict reconciliation and peacemaking in various different situations and communities. These might be workplaces, police departments, in churches where people want to get different groups together. He uses a process he calls peace circles. Fred divides his time between Maine and Iowa, mainly. He goes to other communities, but basically he lives half the year in each place, Maine and Iowa. And we're lucky that right now he's here in Iowa, so I was able to speak with him about his peacemaking process. My guest is Fred Van Loo, a retired attorney, Fred Van Loo, J.D., who now runs a company called Van Loo Mediation and Consulting. You do restorative justice, and I have talked to you about that before, but what I'd like to talk about today is some of the less judicial kinds of things. I think you call them peace circles?
Peacemaking circles.
Peacemaking circles.
I guess I would call it a restorative process under mm-hmm. the umbrella of restorative justice.
And one area I was particularly interested in is you have done circles, peacemaking process, with supporters of Black Lives Matter and police officers. And I'd love to hear some details about that.
We've got two different things happening here. So we have done circles in Des Moines mm-hmm. with the Des Moines police officers mm-hmm. and black teenagers, okay? And we call those community justice circles. With Black Lives Matter, that's still happening. We've done a lot of groundwork, met with police, met with protesters, et cetera. And that particular circle has not been held yet. So we're talking about two different
stages in the process, really.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Right.
Yeah,
right.
Well, that brings up another issue, a related thing, which is it takes a long time to prepare people to meet in these circles. And I'd like you to talk a bit more in detail about
sure,
the process there.
Absolutely. And it depends on the nature of the circle. So you can have a circle as a result of a conflict. Well, you can have a circle as a result of a wrongdoing, okay, that has occurred, or an ongoing conflict, or you can have a circle around a theme or an issue. So, for example, Portland, Maine, where I do work for the Portland Center for Restorative Justice, we do community conversation circles, you know.
Which you've now started in Des Moines, too, right?
Yes, with race as the primary issue, mm-hmm. right? In Portland, we've used it for a number of issues, aging, building community, creating a safe space, that kind of thing. So you can use the peacemaking circle process, in my opinion, for a wide range of issues, themes, conflicts, you know, can be used in the workplace, in schools, and prisons as a result of referrals from the system or not. Just helping communities that are engaged with people in their community. For example, a few weeks ago, I was asked to facilitate circles on two consecutive Thursdays. They were four-hour circles in the near north side of Des Moines, the inner city part of Des Moines, the River Bend Neighborhood Association. But anyway, we brought together some neighborhood activists, community organizers, people involved with organizations working with that neighborhood to really look at what is this neighborhood? You know, what is the complexion of this neighborhood? What are the things that we do well? What do we still need help with? What needs to be done? Who do we need to collaborate with? So that kind of circle, you do some groundwork, talking to some key people, but you don't have to talk to all 20 people that might be in that kind of circle ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, so I did a circle this past year in which a young man made threats via emails to kill some people at a school.
Could I ask how old he was?
He was 16.
Uh-huh.
So after the system did its work, there was a recognition that we need to address community issues.
Right.
We need to bring this young man back into the community.
Mm-hmm.
How do we reintegrate him into the community rather than ostracize? So that circle involved the boy's attorney, parents, superintendent, principal, a couple of students, other parents, trying to get a representation of the community.
Yeah.
And that circle took a couple of months to put together. You know.
So in other words, before they actually sat down in the circle, there were 2 months preparation for that, for getting them face to face.
About 40 hours a week for 8 weeks, but many phone calls, many personal meetings, three lengthy meetings with the boy because of difficulties he had in social settings,
right.
Working with his therapist, sitting down with law enforcement and with school people so that they felt comfortable doing this. They'd never done it before. On the other hand, I do circles at churches on, what does my future look like, And you just put up a notice and invite people to come, and we get 10, 12, 15 people in a circle for a couple of hours. I spent last Friday and Saturday with the church in Cedar Rapids.
Mm-hmm.
It was going through a merger,
Yeah.
And it was going fairly well, but they were being sort of Iowa nice,
Yeah.
And it was really felt there was a need to really look at how did we get here and what are we leaving behind? Where is the sadness? Where is the grief before we can move forward?
Yeah.
Churches and workplaces. Yeah. I mean, if we just step back a little bit and think of often that's how we do communicate normally, in social settings. It's light banter, or maybe we'll get into disagreements over politics, ideologies, et cetera. Or we're in highly structured meetings like board meetings, committee meetings, or that kind of thing. But rarely, if ever, do we say, okay, we're going to set aside an entire evening, we'll say 3 hours, to develop relationships with a dozen or more other people that we may know casually or not. But we're going to take the time to do that, and we're going to have a structure only in that we can use a talking piece so that everybody has an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And they won't be interrupted, and they speak until they're finished, and then it gets passed on. And so it's such a simple process, but nevertheless, it just does not happen in our culture very often.
No, it doesn't.
And so you take it into these places, a workplace. For example, I did some work a couple of years ago with a police department and the 15 dispatchers. It's like a dysfunctional family. And so we spent 4 hours with them getting, they worked with each other all the time, but they didn't know each other. And, they did after that evening. And they not only knew each other, but they liked each other in a way that they didn't at the beginning.
I know you have to be discreet about these things, but can you give us any concrete examples of things that have happened to sort of bring it alive for people?
Well, yeah, I mean, what I've seen in the what I call community justice circles with police officers and youth of color, even though every time you do it, the participants are different, the way it plays out is the same. There's mistrust, distrust, fear at the beginning. There's a tension. And then you start slowly. I'll give you just sort of a metaphor to consider, an image to consider. I think of the peacemaking circle as somewhat like a like an eagle or a hawk that's circling in search of prey or already has identified the prey. And unlike a pelican, hawk or eagle, they don't just swoop down. It's almost like they're in a very lazy way, sort of meandering. And then all of a sudden they're there and mm-hmm. they've got the little mouse, And it's sort of like the circle. You don't jump right into the issue of racial profiling or police excessive use of force, et cetera. You don't start there.
Mm.
You start with telling stories about each other. One of the very, very best, I think, entrees into almost any circle, series of questions that are non-intrusive, at least in the early going. And where I like to take people is back to when they were kids, because when people tell stories about their childhoods, they may be different than ours. But we can connect with them. We can connect with a kid whose father's factory was shut down and the family, went on welfare. We can connect with them, even though we didn't live that life, but we can connect in that, oh my, it's a major event in your life, and I'm sure it shaped your way of thinking. And in fact, it does shape our way of thinking when those kinds of events happen. Or you grow up, and people share stories of growing up with an alcoholic parent or an absent parent, a mentally ill parent, a parent who worked three jobs because they couldn't get a livable wage, So when we hear those early stories or in a circle, it opens people up as a circle keeper, which is where you want,
mm-hmm,
as
mm-hmm.
a keeper, you carry in you at the outset of the circle, this place of feeling where you want people to get to, because that's where the magic is. And I love this expression that I heard about a year or two ago that I hold all the time now, which is the peacemaking circle. This plays out in the way that you hope through your design and then through people coming together, is that a collective soul is born. People still remain individuals. It's not like you're a team or a band. There's this, and people know it. You know, they don't. You don't have to use that term. There's just this ease among people near the end, and they don't want to leave it because they're going back out into the other world.
Yeah, and another sort of deeply polarized thing in our culture is, of course, Democrats and Republicans, Trump supporters and the others. Right. And this presumably is something where you really do have to use this slow circling approach. I wonder
you do, and we've done some of those post-election. A couple of things I do in the early stage or two of the circle is take them back to a time where I ask them, how do you think you came to have the ideology or the political beliefs you have, or vote the way that you do? And the very first time I did this, I think it was in January, and it was a post-election circle. And the responses were all from the head. They were all intellectual. I read this, I saw this, blah, blah, blah. And so the talking piece came back around to me, and I said, you know, that was good, but let's try speaking from the heart this next time, mm-hmm. you know. And in order to do that, I posed a question like, can you remember an early time in your life that looking back now, you can see, that contributed to my worldview, my ideological, political view, you know. Well, that's not an intellectual or head thing. That's very much coming. It's a visceral heart thing. It's like they're coming together because of this post-election thing, and they know that we should be able to talk to each other. But then when we come together, I get into my camp, they get into their camp, you know, and we try to win the argument, you know.
Sure.
And so you got to pull them out of that. Because if you get started down that path early on, you're done for. It's going to be the usual talking over, dismissing, that kind of thing. So you got to pull them out of that to someplace 20, 30, 40 years before Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton weren't on their radar, you know.
And what was on their radar, maybe, that's relevant?
Oftentimes it's around poverty or privilege, race, that kind of thing, where they...
But they have experiences from way back.
From way back, right.
Yeah, yeah.
And you do the same thing when you have a conflict, particularly between people who have had a relationship before. You know, you're come together to mediate or have a dialogue or a circle around where people are in the middle of considerable tension. But I always try to take them back to, if I know that they were friends 2, 3, 5 years ago. You don't say, let's relive this, but, you know, what was it like? How did you meet? What attracted you to Mary? You know, what were the things you did? You know, why is it that you hung out with Mary and not with somebody else? You know, sort of pretty simple, sounds really simple.
Sure, yeah.
But you want them to re-experience those good feelings, right? So then when you come back to the conflict, there's been a dissipation of the negative energy. There's just a core group of us that think, let's set our ideologies aside and be that small group in our community that can help other people come together and have conversations where there's a gap that's bridged, you know. You have to approach it very delicately and patiently, but they're human beings, and I think all human beings are wired to be in circle because of our early history.
Now, if people or organizations want to get in touch with you, can you give them some contact information?
Sure. They can call me. I mean, I divide my time primarily between Iowa and Maine. I do a fair amount of work in Michigan, too, with some communities up there. Actually, I'll just tell you quickly, I'm excited about this. Later in September, I'm going to a community in northwest Michigan, that, like many communities, in the middle of an opiate crisis. And we're going to do a series of community circles, 15 to 20 people each, with law enforcement, judges, addicts, family members of addicts, et cetera, people from the treatment community. And then we're going to come together and have a community meeting after maybe 5 of these community circles. So it's exciting, but they want to do something they don't know. They haven't taken the time to learn about each other's perspectives. You know, what are the challenges that law enforcement meets when dealing with somebody they're dealing with somebody's conduct, but yet that person has an addiction, you know. Mm-hmm. And they haven't taken the time to understand that, you know, because mm-hmm. they're just doing their job. And likewise, the addict doesn't understand where deputy's coming from or the street officer's coming from. So that's exciting for me to go into a community, you know, and not know anyone other than a couple of organizers and just be with people. And there'll be a lot of pain there, you know, and a lot of grief there over lives lost and years lost and children lost, you know. But anyway, my contact information, I mean, I can be emailed at FVL, Fred Van Loo, FVL, mediation, not meditation, but mediation, mediation, @gmail.com. Or I can be called at 515-444-9384.
Okay, I'll just repeat that. It's FVL, which are Fred's initials, FVL, yeah. mediation@gmail.com, or phone 515-444-9384. And we will put this on our website. So if anybody that's interested in reconciliation, peacemaking, and in organizing groups to get together, they can get in touch with Fred. You're listening to Local Talk on KHY Community Radio. I'm Kay Pottock, one of your hosts today, together with Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening. You just heard an interview with Fred Van Loo of Van Loo Mediation and Consulting.
Keith Morgan has joined us. Keith is the Emergency Management Coordinator for Story County. With him is Chris Perrin, who is the Emergency Manager and Security Coordinator for Mary Greeley Medical Center. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you.
Chris has done some great work helping both local healthcare facilities improve their disaster preparedness and bringing them up to federal codes. Keith, would you like to lead the discussion with Chris?
Sure. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. A lot of people don't realize how much our medical facilities are all interlinked and how difficult it can be to prepare them for a disaster. And some recent changes to federal code that Chris is going to talk about have been put in there to incentivize them to do a better job of disaster preparedness. But it wouldn't have gotten to the place that it has without some of the great work Chris has been doing over at Mary Greeley. He's brought together the agencies that provide medical and health care across Story County and is helping to facilitate their advancement of their emergency planning and, more importantly, coordinating it to make it so that it's more efficient and effective across the whole county. And I'd like, first off, Chris to talk about, he's more the expert on this stuff than I am, about the changes to some of the federal code and like that and how it's presented challenges to our local medical facilities and also some of the planning and exercises that he's working on. Chris?
Thanks, Keith. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that we've counted a lot on your help and expertise, as medical is one of several essential functions, and plugging medical into the overall local response plan is has been key. What we're really dealing with is Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Systems or Services rule, emergency preparedness rule, that came into being in November of last year, and it comes into the expectation of full compliance for medical facilities that receive dollars from Medicare, Medicaid by November this coming year.
Chris, can you describe exactly what these places are? Are these clinics? Are they places that dispense pharmacy, or what are the actual locations?
Good question. There's 17 that are identified in the Medicare rule, and they would include clinics, hospitals, critical access hospitals, long-term care facilities, dialysis centers, even transplant centers.
Okay.
So the idea was kind of building on some things that other regulators had done. And for Mary Greeley, we've worked with the Joint Commission for a number of years, and the Joint Commission focuses on hospitals in particular. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid wanted to come together and bring other medical facilities into a kind of a similar line of compliance. So they came up with some rules or standards or guidelines, and they include the need to do a couple of exercises a year, one of them of which needs to be a community exercise. So,
and again, this is in preparation for an emergency.
Correct.
That would occur. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Part of what they expect folks to do is do a really good, hard look at your local risks and come up with a hazards profile, and then get together with other healthcare providers and run simulations. And united we stand, divided we fall in terms of support when there is a disaster. And I think we're realizing that.
If I could, I just want to make sure I've got the right picture in my mind here.
Sure.
So I'm thinking of sort of, a long-term care facility, and there's a disaster and you've got to move all these, say, bedridden people. Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about, or am I completely on the wrong track?
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
I think what Kay is asking is the disaster happening to the facility, or is it in preparation for a disaster happening somewhere else and the facility being ready to deal with the problems that the disaster dealing with injured people or whatever?
Both.
Does that question make sense?
Well put, and it's really both. The expectation is that they be able to provide a good, effective response and communication and safe movement of resources, supplies, and people if necessary. And that would include moving them away from their facility if necessary, or accommodating other medical facilities as we need to move folks around.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can imagine that there is a lot more – it's a lot more complex, even starting from, do you move these patients? Because there's a big risk in moving a lot of these patients that have already got medical issues. The information requirements, just as you were saying, if one care facility keeps its documents in one form and you've got to transfer this patient to another facility and they don't understand how or where the information is kept – it can make it very, very difficult, and some very simple things can be done to smooth out this process. But it's simple until got to get everybody together, get everybody on the same sheet of music, to put together plans, to train to those plans, and to actually do exercises. And the federal guidance was very aggressive. When was it actually published? Like beginning of this year, and they gave them about 6 months to go from nothing to completing one full scale exercise, which is actually moving people and things around, and another one, which is a tabletop where we all sit down and talk through. So it's been more than my office could have ever possibly been able to facilitate, and that's where Chris has come in and brought together all of these agencies, which different levels of care that they're providing, and he's got them talking. And that talk is leading some real progress on this.
It's a start.
Sounds like a huge undertaking. Mm-hmm.
It is, but it's like eating an elephant. It's one bite at a time. So we've got about a dozen healthcare providers that we've started with. And as Keith mentioned, the rule was published in November, but an explanation of what the expectations were didn't really come out until about April of this year. Mm-hmm. And full compliance is expected in November. So
give us a sense of what these expectations are.
Well, they're expecting people to collaboratively come up with what their risks are, create a kind of an all-hazards base plan, then come up with policies and procedures, have a communications plan, both internal and external, and then to exercise that.
So you see, like looking at the threats, most of us think about natural disasters as one of them, but there's always the man-made disasters, a hazardous materials event that could occur, could be one of them, or just pandemic, which will really stress the healthcare system because they have increased number of people that they have to care for, plus their own staff is going to be affected by these kind of disasters. And each one presents a different level and a different type of challenges for them.
So we're talking about potentially floods, tornadoes, disease epidemic, chemical spill. Those are the kind of scenarios you're laying out.
Some that are going to happen very, very rapidly. Some that will be slow building. Some that will be over in a day or so. And some that could last potentially months.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that I know that I am, and I'm sure somebody listening to this is trying to visualize what you're talking about, Chris. Are you saying that you are making a plan where you literally could move everybody out of Mary Greeley Hospital if something happened to the building?
That would be one of the many plans that we put together. We're fortunate that we've had some great expansion, and so we look at vertical movement from one area of the hospital to another. But a significant event in our community where we had a lot of casualties, they would be directed to the hospital, and we may need to move some folks that are about ready to go home, maybe move them a little bit faster along a discharge plan. And sometimes that includes moving them to maybe one of these long-term care facilities for their final day or two of care. So as Keith mentioned, there's tracking issues, there's communication issues, there's medical records, medications. That continuity of care is really important.
Wow. It's a huge task.
And I'll be looking also, if it's a large-scale event, for Chris and the medical community to report up to us to, first off, let us know what your infrastructure is like. Has Mary Greeley, is it still able to receive patients so that we can get the broader perspective? Because this is one of 15 different areas that we're looking at during a disaster. So that communications aspect of it, so that we can then reach out outside of Story County and try and bring in resources from other areas to help us out or start to coordinate to move some of these patients, if need be, outside of the county. So this level of coordination that's got to occur beforehand is absolutely essential. And our resources, our first responders, are already going to be taxed. They're going to be doing the response to the disaster itself. So them being as effective and efficient as possible on their own will be absolutely essential to the overall response.
So when you say when you talk about external support to the medical facilities during disaster, are you talking about reaching out to other communities or external supports within the community that would help medical centers?
Well, always start as close to the issue as possible. So, for instance, if they needed to move patients that could walk, but they didn't have enough transportation, that might be a request that comes on in. Or just plain finding a clear route for them to move patients from one place to the other is some of the ways that we might be doing the external support. We'll reach out to our volunteer organizations, such as the Red Cross and like that, and see if they have any excess capacity that they might bring into us. But the first thing is we have to know what their resource requirements are, and that's very essential. It's very mundane to think about, but communications. Who gathers this information? Who passes it along? Who verifies it? And how do we track that so that we make sure that what's needed gets to the right people in a very timely manner? And again, people, they always get down to the more things that they're used to, you know, the treatment and the triage, whereas this administrative stuff is what's really important to take care of the patients in the whole system.
So where do you start, Chris?
We start by getting together and just talking about our concerns and look at the regulations. I think we're really blessed that the folks that have come to the table, actually there's a few of them that have come to the table that don't have to meet the CMS regulations but want to be part of that community partnership. So I think it's just making room at the table for everybody and letting people know we're in it for the long haul. And we start with a communication piece.
And those meetings are happening now?
They've been happening since this spring, and we're getting ready for some exercises. We're going to do a tabletop, as Keith mentioned, where we kind of walk through an exercise, and then we'll have a full-scale exercise in October. So we'll be in compliance for those that are participating in full compliance by November.
And are there any things that have happened in recent past that kind of qualify as an example of such a situation that you're trying to anticipate?
Well, they've in real life, of course, we've had floods, and we've had a couple of near misses in terms of tornadoes where significant property damage that could have resulted in a personal injury as well. Honestly, we've simulated an awful lot of of scenarios, and it could be, again, as Keith was mentioning earlier, it could be an overturned train or truck with a hazmat release in a population center that we'd then have to do some evacuation and medical treatment and so on.
But you look at what happened down in Joplin, where the major regional medical center was essentially put out of action right away.
That's right.
This will help us be able to adapt to that kind of a situation here. Or, again, we could even be partners if something like that should happen down in Polk County, be on the receiving end of it. So it is mm-hmm. definitely a two-way. That is, as we call it, the teachable moment. People say, oh, it won't happen, it won't happen. But the pictures that you see and some of the after-action items we've heard of from the Joplin, where they adapted and they set up treatment out in the community and really overcame quite a traumatic event. We want to be better prepared. You're never completely prepared for that, but if you've got people talking, they'll adapt to whatever the situation was if they thought through it to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Keith. And will you come back, Chris, as things develop and
sure.
give us an update on what's being done?
Absolutely.
Okay, that'd be great.
Yeah, well,
thank you, Keith.
Thank you. We've been talking with Chris Perrin, who is the Emergency Management and Security Coordinator for Mary Greeley Medical Center. Thank you, Chris. And our regular monthly guest, Keith Morgan.
And earlier on the show, we heard from Fred Van Loo and Rhea Kinert. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. And also remember, you can hear it online at khoifm.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. Remember that you as the listener are the most important part of KHOI.
KHOI is grateful to sponsors in the business community who are making our birthday celebration possible. Today's birthday sponsor of the day is Benjamin Designs, collaborative, an architectural firm located in downtown Ames that specializes in sustainable architecture and solar design. Offices located at Clark Avenue or call 515-232-0888. Again, 515-232-0888.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.